So, I will be continuing from Ajahn Jayasaro's translation of Lompo Cha's biography, where Tanchinda left off yesterday. A simple monk. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it is related that on one occasion, Venerable Radha went to pay homage to the Buddha and requested a short teaching, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Then, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, he rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. This was Ajahn Chah's way also. He does not seem to have ever felt the need for close and continuous guidance from an enlightened teacher. Despite the profound impression Lungpo Mon made upon him, for instance, he stayed with that great master a mere 2 days and never returned for a second visit. Teachers were a resource that he drew upon to his form his own singular aspiration and self-discipline. Ajahn Chah said that in the presence of teachers, he would not usually ask many questions, but preferred to listen, observe, and learn from his own experience. It is not that he held a principled objection to such commitment, however. Indeed, as a teacher himself, he stressed the importance of young monks spending the first 5 years of their monastic career in dependence on a senior monk. In later years, he would tell his own disciples that they were luckier than he had been. In the first years of monkhood, they received from him the kind of guidance that he had never had when he was their age. Of the monks that Ajahn Chah looked up to and praised to his disciples, the two that took pride of place apart from Lungpo Mon were Lungpo Tongrat and Lungpo Ginri. These two monks were friends. They belonged to the small fraternity of Lungpo Bun's disciples, who maintained their affiliation with the Mahanikaya sect. Their personalities could hardly have been more different. While Lungpo Tongrat was fierce and unconventional, Lungpo Ginri was quiet and unobtrusive. Ajahn Chah praised Lungpo Tongrat's fearlessness and sense of humor, Lungpo Ginri's simplicity, his ability to maintain mindfulness in all postures, and his patient attention to detail. It was with Lungpo Ginri that Ajahn Chah had the most contact. He spent little time with Lungpo Tongrat. Indeed, no record survives of exactly when and how they met, although their first meeting had become legendary thanks to Lungpo Tongrat's greeting of the young monk he'd never met before with the words, "So you're Chah, are you?" Ajahn Chah's relationship to Lungpo Ginri is clearer. It began in that hot season of 1950 and lasted until the latter's death in 1979. In the last years of Lungpo Ginri's life, he was cared for by monks sent from Wat Bopong by Ajahn Chah. Lungpo Ginri had led an eventful monastic life. After receiving teachings from Lungpo Mun and Lungpo Sao, he had spent many years wandering on Tudong, including over 10 years in Burma. He was one of only a handful of monks of his generation to have visited the Buddhist holy places in northeast India. Yet by the time Ajahn Chah knew him, Lungpo Ginri did not have the air of a hard and seasoned traveler. He wore about him, like an old, well-used robe, a modest self-sufficiency and ease that spoke of someone with nothing more to prove to himself. He seemed content with what each moment brought him. Ajahn Chah soon found that the fact that he rarely spoke was not mere taciturnity, but rather the fruit of a sweet, gentle nature, so at home in silence that he rarely saw reason to disturb it with speech. He was an industrious man who would spend his days tinkering, pottering, sewing, cleaning. All of his requisites he made himself and used them until they fell apart. As he got older, his appearance became ever more shabby and decrepit, but as Ajahn Chah discovered, his mind remained bright and clean. Ajahn Chah's initial visit to Wat Nong He, Lungpo Ginri's monastery, was a short one. He found Lungpo Ginri's customary epileptic and poetic advice on practice hard to understand and yet intriguing. Every now and again a blunter teaching got through. He was impressed enough to decide to return for the rains. At that time, I'd hear the teachers giving Dhamma talks about letting go, and I still couldn't really understand. Lamborghini asked me to sew a set of robes. I went at it flat out. I wanted to get it over and done with quickly. Once the task was done, I thought, I'd be free of business and able to get down to some meditation. One day, Lungpur walked over. I was sewing out in the sun, totally unaware of the heat. I just wanted to get it finished so I could devote myself to meditation. He asked me, what's the hurry? I'm hurrying to get it finished. When you've finished, what are you going to do? I'm going to meditate. After you've done that, what are you going to do? I'm going to do so-and-so. Then when you've finished that, what are you going to do? I'm going to do so-and-so. And then what will you do? There would be no end of this. He said, don't you realize that it's just this sewing that is your meditation? Where are you rushing off to? You've already gone wrong. Craving is flooding through your head, and you've no idea what's going on. Another shaft of light. I'd been sure I was making merit. I'd thought merely doing the job was good enough. I'd get it done quickly and go on to something else. But Lumpur pointed out my mistake. What was the hurry? No woman, no cry. But the old demon of lust was still lurking in the shadows, biding its time. While practicing at Wat Ban Dorn in Nakhon province, Ajahn Chah became aware, with a mixture of excitement and fear, that he was the object of the glances and modest smiles of an attractive woman. To realize that he is desired adds a new dimension to a monk's imaginings, an extra twist of the knife. Ajahn Chah began to look forward to and dread in equal measure the mealtime when he would be painfully conscious of the presence of the young widow of Ban Dorn village. A young widow is apt to be looked upon with some suspicion if a sudden surge of faith carries her to the monastery every morning, especially if the Wat contains young monks to see and be seen by. If, in addition to her youth, she is beautiful and wealthy, there may well be consternation in the kitchen, where the old ladies like to spice their pounding of green papaya with a sprinkling of gossip and speculation. Ajahn Chah's devotee was soon noticed and resented. In Isan folklore, the wily young widow entrapping the innocent monk secretly chafing in his purity is a familiar theme. Its popularity is perhaps due to the singularity of such a subtle courtship initiated, cued, and paced by the woman rather than the man. At Ban Dorn, it was almost as if the protagonist was following the script of the minstrels. She would bring her son to the daily meal offering and ensure that he got close to Ajahn Chah in a way that she could not herself. Before long, Ajahn Chah had conceived a warm affection for the boy, and as his thoughts turned more and more to the mother, paternal feelings for the boy aggravated the wavering in his mind. Desire has its own logic and imperatives. Resolutions that had such a short time before been so inspiring to him in his meditation practice now seemed to Ajahn Chah flat and unconvincing. His mind was wrought by conflict. One night, the most compelling fantasies, ranging from the innocent and romantic to the coarse and obscene, threatened to completely flood his mind. He realized in a cold sweat that the dam of his restraint was beginning to crack. A few minutes later, his things were packed, and he was urgently rousing his companion, Pakao Gao. Can't you wait until tomorrow morning? No. Ajahn Chah's voice was gruff in the darkness. We're going right now. And so they left. With Ajahn Chah striding grimly along the dusty moonlit path and an old disgruntled Pakao some yards back struggling to keep up. A problem with robes. After Ajahn Chah had abandoned the life of the wandering mendicant and established his monastery, Wat Papong, he would often, in the course of Dhamma talks to the Sangha, refer to his early days of practice. In relating his experiences as a young monk, he would emphasize his own weaknesses and the problems he had faced with a self-depreciating humor and frankness. Ajahn Chah was a shrewd psychologist. He wanted his disciples to see that their teacher had been through the very same apparent boundless quagmire that they themselves were struggling through and had come out on the other side. On one occasion, he recalled how, in his first year of Tudong, he had experienced a great craving for requisites and suffered accordingly. When I entered the circle of forest monks, their requisites all seemed so beautiful. Their bowls were immaculate, and the color and texture of their robes looked so good. I didn't have a single piece of cloth that wasn't unsightly. I wanted a new jiwan. I still didn't have a two-layer sangati. I was full of discontent. I went up to Sisankrom district, and Lungpor Put gave me an old robe that he'd been wearing for 4 years. I was really happy. The border was all torn, but I managed to find a discarded bathing cloth to make a patch. The color of the patch didn't fit. It looked like the border stripes on the skirt that the local women wore. When I went on Alms Round, everyone looked at me. They stared so much that I felt discouraged. It was a problem. I was embarrassed and redyed the cloth, but no matter how much I tried, it was just too old to take the color well. Prakrujan had said to let him know if I needed any requisites, but I was determined not to ask for anything, and so I just carried on like that until Ajahn Sawai, observing my patience and my way of practice, sewed me a robe. That made me feel happy. If I'd asked for a robe from him at the start, I would have been uncomfortable about receiving it, because it would have been acquired through expressing my desires. So my views flipped over. Now I looked down on anything that had been purchased, ordered, or asked for. But if I acquired something without seeking it, even if it was not in particularly good condition, as long as it was still repairable, it seemed wonderful. On that trip to Sisankrom, I had one small angsa. I couldn't ask for another. It would have been an offense against the discipline. I didn't know what to do. I wanted a new one. My mind was restless and agitated. I worried about robes so much that I worked out how to make a jiwan. I planned out step by step what I'd do with the cloth, even though there was no sign of a prospective donor. While I was walking Jongrum, I'd be marking out the robe in my mind. Whenever I got some cloth, I thought I'd be able to get down to work straight away. I was obsessed. On Alms Round, all I saw were the markings on the cloth. I went through it so often in my mind that I worked it all out. I was as absorbed in that imaginary robe as a flea or a louse who'd made it its home. I'd never seen anyone make the two layers sangati, but before I worked it out, I was so interested and I had such a strong desire that I gave it a lot of thought. I determined the method of sewing the robe and of attaching the border, every last detail, until I could do it, until I could visualize it all very clearly. So when I was offered some cloth, I was able to start straight away. Why not? I was proficient. I could cut the main robe, and as for the two-layer sangati, I was even more fluent. How could I fail to be after being so obsessed? This is what is meant by the saying that wherever there is interest, there is success. Meditation is the same. If you're interested, you don't sleep very much. The mind is awake, it's concentrating, it's looking. That's like that. This is like this, until you're proficient. I'd been wearing my sabong for 2 years, and it was almost threadbare. I'd have to hitch it up when I sat down. One day, I was sweeping leaves in the central area of the monastery at Ban Pad Dao. It was hot, and I was sweating. Unthinking, I squatted down for a rest without hitching the sabong first, and it ripped right across the backside. I had to borrow a layman's sarong. There was no patching cloth around, and so in the end, I had to wash a foot-wiping rag and put the patch on the inside of the sabong. I sat down and started thinking. Why did the Buddha make us monks suffer so much? You can't ask for cloth. You can't do anything to help yourself. I felt dispirited. Both my jiwan and my sabong were torn. I sat in meditation, and I was able to make a fresh resolve. I thought, all right, whatever happens, I'm not going to give up. If I've got no robes, I'll just go naked. My mind was really fired up. I thought I'd take things to the limit and see what it would be like. From then on, I wore robes patched front and back and gave up thoughts of changing them. I went to pay respects to Tan Ajahn Kinneri again. While I was staying with him, I wasn't like the others, and neither was he. He was watching me. I didn't ask for anything while I was there. Whenever my robes ripped a bit more, I found cloth to patch them. He didn't invite me to stay, and I didn't ask to stay, yet I stayed anyway, steadily continuing my practice. We didn't speak to each other. It was almost like a kind of contest. Just before the rains retreat, he must have told one of his relations that there was a monk come to stay whose robes were in tatters. He asked them to make a new set from some hand-woven cloth that had been offered a short while before, thick, sturdy material dyed in jackfruit dye. The nuns sewed the whole thing by hand using coarse pulling thread. I was overjoyed. I wore that robe 4 or 5 years without a single rip. The first time I wore it, it looked like a big earthenware pot, because the new cloth was very stiff and didn't adapt to the shape of my body. When I walked, it made a loud shwoosh-wop sound. With my sangati worn on top of it, the extra 2 layers of cloth made me look even more immense. If I'd worn that robe up a mountain and met a yellow tiger, I'm sure it wouldn't have dared attack. Its roar would have died in its mouth. It would have been completely bemused by the stiff yellow figure in front of it. I didn't ever grumble about that robe, and after I'd been wearing it for a year or so, it started to soften up. I wore that robe for a long time, and to this day I'm conscious of the debt of gratitude I owe to Lungpo Ginri for giving it to me without being asked. It was great good fortune. From the time I received that robe, my feelings of discontent left me. When I looked at my actions from the past until the present and into the future, it made me remember that whatever volitional action isn't false and doesn't cause distress makes one feel content and happy. That is good karma. It was the opinion I held, and perceiving its truth made it seem that things were starting to fit into place, and so I accelerated my meditation practice for all I was worth. Ajahn Chah kept up his walking meditation, even if the sun was fierce or the rain was pouring down, until the center of his walking path was worn into a furrow. Lungpo Ginri, on the other hand, hardly walked at all. Sometimes he might be seen strolling up and down on his meditation path 2 or 3 times and then sitting down in a shady place, start to patch a piece of cloth. I assumed that he was getting nowhere. He didn't walk Jhongrum. He never sat for very long. He would just potter around doing this and that the whole day. As for me, I thought, I hardly take a moment's rest, and I still haven't realized anything. If Lungpo is practicing like this, what can he ever hope to achieve? I got it wrong. Lungpo Ginri knew far more than me. He seldom gave admonitions, and those he did were terse, but his words were always profound and imbued with a keen wisdom. Ajahn Chah was to say many years later that the longer he lived with Lungpo Ginri, the more he respected him. He summarized the important lesson he had learned. The scope of a teacher's vision far exceeds that of our own. It's the effort to eradicate the defilements within the mind that is the essence of practice. You can't judge the teacher by how much he sits and walks. During the rains retreat, sexual desire, a thrashing, pounding storm of it, returned to assail Ajahn Chah's body and mind just as he was putting everything into his meditation practice. A modern interpretation might be that such single-minded introspection brought repressed desires to the surface. The most usual way for the forest teachers to describe this phenomenon, however, is to personalize the defilements as tyrants who have held sway over the mind for countless lifetimes, and now, seeing a threat to their hegemony, react violently with the most powerful forces at their disposal. Whatever the explanation, Ajahn Chah suddenly found himself in that hot, damp forest, engulfed in a realm of vaginas. Eyes opened or closed, hundreds of the hallucinatory images surrounded him, devastatingly real. The intensity of the lust was almost unbearable, as fierce in its way as the fear he had felt in the cremation forest. There was nothing to do but grimly endure. Some explanation may be called for to make clear the full extent of Ajahn Chah's predicament. The Buddha taught that on the path to enlightenment, sexual desire can, and eventually indeed must be, completely transcended. To this end, monks undertake an absolute form of celibacy in order to isolate and reveal the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and impersonal nature of sexual desire, and thus uproot identification with it. The weight of the discipline is thrown behind this practice by making intentional emission of semen one of its most serious offenses. A monk who transgresses is liable to a period of penance and rehabilitation that is deeply embarrassing to him personally. He has, for instance, to acknowledge his offense to the Sangha on every day of the penance, and inconvenient for the monastic community as a whole. Even if he stops short of masturbation, a monk who makes the slightest deliberate attempt to excite himself sexually or physically, relieve sexual feelings, commits an offense. He is given, therefore, absolutely no choice but to face up to the tension of lust. Until liberating insight arises, and few are ever completely successful in their efforts to experience that, it is by patient endurance, calmness of mind, and confidence in the value of struggling with such feelings that a monk must be sustained. Ajahn Chah was in constant fear of ejaculation. He did not dare walk Chongram. He was afraid that if the friction of the sabong stimulated his penis too much, he would be unable to control himself. He asked a layman to make him a walking path deep in the forest, and at nighttime he would walk there, his sabong hitched up around his waist. It was a full 10 days before the alluring visions and the lust they engendered finally faded. Many years later, Ajahn Chah told his oldest friend, poor Foot, that the vaginas belonged to his wives of previous existences. Perhaps his remark was spoken in jest, perhaps not, but whatever the origin of the visions, this episode was to prove the last great hurrah of his sexual nature. Sexual desire is a major problem for many young monks, and in their later years, Ajahn Chah was to speak of this incident to his disciples on a number of occasions. He was keen for them to see that such feelings were natural and that with determination could be transcended. He himself had survived the onslaught not through an intimidating amount of concentration or dazzling wisdom, but with good old-fashioned, teeth-gritting endurance and a clear recognition that this, too, was bound to be impermanent. In 1968, when the first biography of Ajahn Chah was being written, he insisted that this episode be included. His biographer was rather uneasy about how such frank revelations would go down with the general public. It was not, after all, the usual bill of fare in the lives of saints. Ajahn Chah said that if he omitted that passage, then he could just forget about the whole book. The rains retreat at Wat Pa Nong Hi was not all such blood and thunder grimness. On the contrary, one night, at the end of a long period of meditation, as Ajahn Chah lay down to sleep, he was greeted by a vision of Lungpur Mun standing in front of him, holding out a glittering jewel. Lungpur Mun began to speak. "Chah, I'm giving this to you. See how bright and radiant it is." Ajahn Chah sat up and stretched out his right hand to receive the jewel. At that moment he woke up. He found himself sitting up on his mat with his hand forming a fist, as if grasping something supremely precious. His spirits received a tremendous spur from that auspicious vision. For the remainder of the retreat, he was fired by an unquenchable enthusiasm for practice. Ajahn Chah remained at Nong Hi until the hot season of the following year, 1948, when, under a searing sun, he resumed his wandering once more. But first, following the ancient tradition, he offered to Lungpur Ginri a tray of candles, incense, and toothwoods that he had made himself from the astringent kota tree, and asked forgiveness for any faults he might have knowingly or unknowingly committed during his stay. Lungpur Ginri praised Ajahn Chah's dedication to his practice, but warned him of the distractions that might arise with his gift for expounding the Dhamma. "Tan Chah, everything in your practice is fine, but be wary of giving talks." On one occasion, many years later, Ajahn Chah spoke of his Tudong years as follows. "In those days, I didn't even have a water filter. Requisites were very hard to come by. I had a tiny aluminum dipper that I was very possessive of. I still smoked in those days. There were no matches, and then I used a flint made from a length of bamboo with half a lemon skin as a cap. At night time, when I was weary from walking Chongram, then I'd sit down and light a cigarette. I reckon that if there were ever any spirits around, the sound of striking that flint, bok, bok, in the middle of the night would have frightened them all away. When I look back on the days when I was practicing alone, it was painful, and full of the most extreme tribulations, and yet at the same time I really enjoyed it. The enjoyment and the suffering went together. Pretty much the same as eating grilled pega leaves dipped in chili sauce and ground ginger. It's delicious, but it's hot. You're eating it and the snot's flowing down, but you can't stop because it tastes so good. You're eating away and at the same time you're groaning, oh, oh. That's what the practice was like in those days. You have to be really tough to practice Dhamma. It's not a light thing. It's heavy. You have to put your life on the line. A tiger is going to eat you, an elephant's going to trample you, then so be it. You think like that. When you've kept your precepts purely, there's nothing to worry about. It's as if you're already dead. If you die, then it's as if there's nothing to die, and so you're not afraid. This is called the weapon of Dhamma. I've been on mountaintops all over the country, and this single weapon of Dhamma has always triumphed. You completely let go. You're bold. You're ready to die. You risk your life. As I thought about it, I saw how the weapon of the Buddha strengthens the mind. It's the best of all weapons. I kept reflecting, looking, thinking, seeing. When the mind sees, it penetrates things completely. Suffering is like this. The cessation of suffering is like this. And so there's ease and contentment. But someone who sees suffering but is content with the peaceful feelings that arise and doesn't really penetrate suffering, they have no way of knowing this. If someone is unafraid of death, if they're ready to give their life, then they don't die. Let suffering go beyond suffering, and eventually it comes to an end. Comprehend it, see the truth, see the nature of things. That has real value. It makes the mind staunch and indomitable. Do you think it would be possible for such a mind to be afraid of people, to be afraid of the forest, to be afraid of wild animals? It is unwavering. All this is called vitakka. Vitakka raises something up, and then vichara investigates it. These two things keep working together until you fully penetrate the matter, and then piti arises in the mind. My hair stood on end. I thought of walking Jhongrum, or of the virtues of the Buddha, or the Dhamma, and the rapture seeped through my whole body and refreshed it. As I sat there, my mind overflowed with joy in my actions, how I'd overcome all the obstacles, and my hair stood on end and the tears started to fall. I felt even more inspiration to struggle and persevere. There was no question of discouragement arising, whatever happened. There was an initial and sustained application of the mind and rapture, and then a happiness that was accompanied by wisdom dependent on that application of mind and that firmly established happiness. At that moment, you could say it was dependent on the power of jhana, if you like, I don't know. That's just how it was. If you want to call it jhana, then go ahead. Before long, vitakka and vichara was abandoned, piti disappeared, and the mind was one-pointed, samadhi was firmly established, and the peace that is a foundation for wisdom had arisen. So I gained the insight that it's through practicing that knowing and seeing take place. Studying and thinking about it is something else again. Even the thoughts and assumptions you make about how things will be are included in the things that you see clearly, and they show themselves to be in contradiction with how things are. So now I was content. Fat or thin, healthy or ill, I was content. I never wondered where my mother was, or where this or that friend or relation was. There was none of that. I just resolved in my mind that if I died, then I died, and that was all there was to it. I had no worries. That was how firm my mind was, and so there was no more holding back. My mind was invigorated and pushed me on. However many Dhamma talks you listen to, however much study you do, the knowledge you gain from that doesn't take you as far as the truth itself, and so it can never free you of doubts and hesitation. You have to practice. If your knowledge is a realization of the truth, then things come to a conclusion. I don't know how you'd put it into words, but it just happens naturally. It's inevitable. It's nothing other than the normal mind arising. Outside the monastery was a Outside the monastery was a cremation forest in which a small open-sided pavilion stood humbly amongst the graves. And in this secluded spot, Ajahn Chah would spend much of his time. One day, while he was sitting in meditation in the In the pavilion, a crow swooped down to the slender branch of a nearby tree and began to crow loudly. Ajahn Chah paid no attention to it. Seeing his indifference, the crow glided down from its perch and placed the dried grass it held in its beak on the ground in front of him. It stood there staring at Ajahn Chah for a while and crowing insistently, "Gah, gah, gah." He was struck by the strangeness of the crow's behavior. It was as if the grass was some kind of gift or sign. As soon as the crow noticed it had caught Ajahn Chah's interest, it abandoned the grass on the ground and flew away. Three days later, the villagers carried the body of a 13-year-old boy into the forest. He had died of a fever, and they buried him by the side of the pavilion. 3 or 4 days later, the crow came to visit Ajahn Chah again, bearing with it another mouthful of dried grass and acting in exactly the same way as on the previous occasion. Within a few days, the brother of the first child was born into the forest, victim of a sudden and inexplicable illness. Just 3 days later, the crow returned once more, and shortly afterwards, with a strange inevitability, the corpse of another child was brought into the forest for burial. This time, it was the elder sister of the two boys. The parents and close relatives of the dead children followed the funeral bier, bowed and shrunken with grief. The sight of the third young corpse and the desolate funeral party filled Ajahn Chah with an intensely cool and sober sadness. The phrase cool and sober sadness is a translation of a difficult Thai term, salat sangwat. The problem in rendering this phrase accurately is not merely one of language. It is a term that employs everyday words to describe an unusual experience, one that arises as a result of Buddhist meditation and as such not fully accessible to non-meditators, even Buddhist ones. It is both like and unlike ordinary sorrow. Perhaps it might be called an elevated or transfigured sorrow. Intensive Buddhist meditation practice makes the mind extremely sensitive, but this is not the sensitivity of the highly strung. It is a receptivity to the truth of the human condition that is born of a calmness and stability of mind that, in the ancient simile, is said to reflect the nature of things like a still forest pool. Meditation imparts a profundity and universal context to the daily tragedies of human existence. Events are experienced as external expressions of the all-embracing instability and insubstantiality being investigated within. Ajahn Chah saw that in the ragged group of mourners that dragged past him, as if nakedly exposed, the pain that is inseparable from love and affectionate attachment, but that for most people only becomes apparent when its object is removed. He was filled with salat sangwat. The truths of human existence that Ajahn Chah was confronted with in the cremation forest aroused him to even greater efforts. He further increased his hours of meditation practice and reduced still more his already meager hours of sleep. He would keep walking Jhongrum even as the rain poured down and created puddles around his feet. As a rice farmer, he had plowed the fields in such weather, he reasoned. Why could he not endure the rain for the sake of this far more valuable work? One day, during a meditation session, Ajahn Chah had a vision. In it, he saw himself walking along a road and passing by an old man, racked by pain, groaning pitifully. He stopped, did not move towards the man, but stood contemplating the sad figure for some time and then walked on. Further along the way, he saw a body lying in the dirt by the side of the road. It was a man on the point of death, terribly emaciated, his breath weak and fitful. After stopping to contemplate the sight, Ajahn Chah continued on his way once more. Finally, he came across a bloated and discolored corpse, its eyes protruding grotesquely, its swollen black tongue cramming the mouth, running all over with maggots. The sense of sober sadness these images evoked was all-encompassing and remained clearly in his mind's eye in the following weeks, deepening his growing disenchantment with conditioned existence and his strong desire for liberation from the attachments that still bound him to it. Mm-hmm.
for is somewhat Tyler from San Diego.
It's from San Diego. It's actually some solo San Diego. So it's using the San Diego from Polly and Ty sizing. But it has a slightly different tone to it. Sometimes you can reduce it to that kind of sobering sadness that moves the heart.
And the salat, what is that?
Salot,
what is that?
Similar.
Actually the same as in Pali, where you use it as a ramps up the feeling. Yeah.
How common is burial in Thailand as opposed to cremation?
Burial is reserved for children. Nowadays it's less common, but in the old days, if you were very young, then they wouldn't do a cremation. You just do a burial, and then a violent death, or a sudden inexplicable death. Then they would do burial as opposed to cremation. And then some say something like suicide, then similarly you'd do burial, and then it would maybe 3 years down the line then you would do cremation and pick it up. It's all similar with a violent death accident, something like that. Then you wouldn't do a cremation quickly. You would you'd bury the body, or sometimes you'd put it in like a sarcophagus and keep the body for 2-3 years, and then do the cremation later. It has a very practical, say the custom has a very practical root in the sense that if somebody is not like a sudden or violent death, if somebody's not prepared for their death, then the logic is it's helpful to have the body there for the person after their death to be able to see their body, see that they're dead, see their relationship, and for that to actually be brought into consciousness that okay, that I'm actually dead, because there's a person that I met, who he talked about his he was shot out in the fields, and he was and it's not it's sort of similar where he was shot and then he's killed, and then he was around there, and then he saw his family come, and then they're kind of weeping and just distraught, and he is sort of trying to say, "It's okay, I'm okay." But then it was when he saw the actual body, he said, "Oh, that's me. Oh, I'm dead." So that then he said he had to integrate that into his spirit of walking. Now what do I do? Okay. Yeah. So that was fairly quick transition of being able to accept death. Whereas that's not necessarily the case. So having the if the body is cremated quite quickly, then there's no physical reminder that I'm actually dead. I do have to move on, and that's oftentimes where ghosts come from. They don't actually recognize that they're dead.
And with the children, was it some practical custom related?
I think it's a bit more. It's when they're young children. Oftentimes, it's. This is village culture, not in the cities, but in the village. Then it's life is a lot tougher, and this is part of children oftentimes don't make it. So then it's just okay. Once they get over about 5 or 6, then it's okay. Looks like they're gonna make it. There's still the same sort of grief and attachment, but there's a kind of a very earthy. These are farmers and villagers, and so it's this is a part of the cycle of life.
I just had a quick question about Ajahn Chah's Dhamma talks. When it seems like he used a lot of these things to encourage monks, these stories. Was he also this frank in terms of like just like a general Dhamma talk about his past life in terms of the things that he went through? Was it kind of transparent, or was it sort of more like appropriate? Like he just.
Oh, I mean, it's very appropriate. I mean, also, he gave a lot of Dhamma talks. So that it isn't as if it comes up in every talk, but I mean he would, and then oftentimes, and also it's depending on the circumstance, it'd be what is he trying to accomplish, in the sense of and what's the audience. I mean, he's very tuned into people. And so that, if he's talking to lay people, if he's talking to monks, whether he's talking to nuns, or he's talking to a group that's, that sort of fired up in practice, or people who are having difficulty, then he's going to adjust, the content and the stories accordingly. But he was, he was always willing to bring in some of his own personal experience and use that to illustrate Dhamma principles. He was a skilled storyteller. So that on a certain level, if you're going to tell a story, and sometimes you've got a personal element to it, and it has it flows a bit better sometimes. But you have to put it in the context of many years of teaching, and then pull those. He would pull that out from time to time to encourage or admonish, to illustrate a particular Dhamma point.
Did he at one point say something like, "I'm such a good teacher because I had so many defilements"?
Something like that, yes. He said, "The reason I can teach well is because I've had to go through so many difficulties." I remember one time, what the heck were we doing? You know, there's that picture of a group of us, together, it's like Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Kema Dhammo and Ajahn P and myself and Pura, there's several together with Ajahn Chah. Now, that was taken in Bangkok. And we went down, we went on a train, it was on the day train, sitting in the day train through the third class seats with Lopa Cha and Ajahn V, he had picked up his, he had his hand, he was sort of massaging it, and he was there. And he was I've been hearing people talk about palmistry and saying, you know, sometimes, you know, there are people that you know, should, if they, their minds were really, really pure, then they'd have just really clean lines on their hands, and, you know, according to palmistry. Said, and yours are really, you've got a lot of lines. And Ajahn Paul said, well, yeah. He said, that's because of a lot of difficulties, a lot of defilements to work with. So there it is. So, yeah.
Before in the story about the big battle with lust,
mm-hmm.
I was curious that his only technique was just sort of to grit his teeth and just sort of endure, like the visions that were coming in. He didn't talk about bringing up a super practice or anything like that, which is a kind of a conventional recommendation.
I think the reality is that I'm sure that he was trying everything. Yeah. And I actually talked to him about it one time when we were on our own. And he said, I tried everything, and it was just really overpowering. And I said, well, what worked? And he said, I just had to keep reminding myself that this has to be impermanent. And it was. He said, so he's trying everything in the array of Dhamma tools but in the end, what actually worked was just being patient with it and being reminding himself that okay, this is a conditioned phenomena that has to be impermanent. Okay, paraphernalia.